I'm here today with His Excellency Batu Kutelia, the Ambassador of the Republic of Georgia to the United States. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Mr. Ambassador, you've held a wide range of positions across several ministries in the government of Georgia dealing with policing, security, military issues. Could you slowly just run us through your experience in the government, your progression through those positions?
By education, I'm a physicist, but since 96, I was involved in the diplomatic service, working in the Department for Political Military Affairs, and dealing with various issues of security policy. After the Rose Revolution, I was appointed as a Chief of Foreign Intelligence Service, before I was, for a short period, Deputy Minister for State Security when this agency was dissolved and merged to the Ministry of Interior. I was then Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs and then First Deputy Minister of Defense. So this was my involvement, but in every portfolio, the key element in my portfolio was reforming the structure to the modern standards, and particularly we had the NATO standard in mind to be interoperable with the Western system of these organizations, and to change all the legacies that were inherited due to some historical Soviet past.
Great, thank you. That touches on several issues I hope to get into a little more depth in a second. But firstly, you mentioned the Soviet past and the legacy of that system. Could you perhaps elaborate on the environment that existed in Georgia prior to 2003, the public's relation to the police, to other security services?
What we inherited was the typical Soviet type of law enforcement system with the very heavy and politicized Ministry of State Security, Ministry of Security, and also Ministry of Internal Affairs, and these two organizations were used kind of maintaining balance in the country, and they had a different influence on different groups, almost necessarily in every post-Soviet country they had a very bad relations with each other. They were kind of rivals. Besides this, they were heavily loaded with different type of functions, including the monitoring of economic activity. Each of them had it. It was a total duplication of functions. Monitoring of economic activity. They had their own paramilitary type or militarized units, special forces. Even Ministry of Interior had special interior troops, which were heavily armed troops, which were totally unnecessary for the interior functions. And what was the most important, both systems, law enforcement general system, they were extremely corrupted. And this corruption was on every level, starting from the individual policeman on the street and going to the highest top level of the chain of command. So that was legacy that we inherited, and there was an urgent necessity to change it, and to change it in a very short period of time, which was quite a challenging task ahead of us.
So you mentioned the pre-existing rivalry between the Ministry of State Security and the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Could you talk to how you addressed that when you were in the State Security before the amalgamation into the unified ministry?
There were a few issues on the agenda to reform the agency. First of all, the most important element was the personnel change. Both of these agencies were extremely big in their size and the number, which was totally unnecessary for the country like Georgia is. So we made a significant decrease of the personnel in the Ministry of Interior as well as the Ministry of State Security. While in one hand it was an important thing to do, and in a very short period of time, it was also issue of concern, because immediately letting jobless in the streets people who have some special skills, maybe not excellent, but at least they've been doing the stuff and possessing some information, was rather dangerous. So we tried to accommodate these two issues in a general personal management policy as well. There were some programs for training these people, those who had willingness to stay, and those who passed this retraining, they could stay and take a position, maybe not position they had before, but which was adequate to the new structure of the system. But the key decision was made to merge these two agencies together and to remove the remnants of Soviet type of KGB, which was this Ministry of State Security and very politicized tool for the control of some domestic political environment. And for a democratic society, it was totally unacceptable to have entities such as the Ministry of State Security. The second step we did is that to make for the society to feel the immediate relief of the corrupted system, we dismissed all the traffic police, which was the extremely corrupted and who had a daily interaction with the drivers and with the society. There were a lot of question marks, and some of our friends were asking as well that whether it will totally deteriorate situation on the ground, just releasing all the traffic police. But just the opposite happened. Society was very cautious, knowing that there is no traffic police, and they felt this relief. But on the other hand, in terms of not violating rules on the streets, they themselves were taking some measures until new patrol police was introduced, and this patrol police was designed and implemented in absolute correlation with the Western standards. And this was one of the real success stories in the shortest period of time possible. Of course, this was possible to achieve by the assistance of our friends, and particularly United States as well. The relevant agencies were involved in the training of Georgian Patrol Police. We established the police academy, and huge assistance was provided to us by the United States. And all the policemen, notwithstanding what was their rank, they had to pass through the special training and then, of course, have an exams to take this or another position. The another element also besides this traffic police reform was important element as well to demilitarize totally the law enforcement agencies. We abolished the Ministry of Interior troops and all the heavy armament and equipment was transferred to the Ministry of Defense. They were totally abolished, and only special type of units which are necessary for the police type of special operations are today operational under the Ministry of Interior. And this third also very important element that was the huge concern of the our population was the very corrupted criminal investigative system. And almost daily violation of human rights of the detainees or suspects or ordinary citizens. We established a very strong monitoring system of daily activity of the criminal investigative team of the Ministry of Interior. Besides this, there was a special training conducted on the interrogation, on the dealing with the procedure and abiding the procedural law. Also, huge investments were made in the special laboratories, which could allow more successful conduct of the investigation and gathering evidences. And what was also important, there was a special institution created within the Ministry of Interior Affairs, who was taking care of the human rights, and which was quite frequently abused before. So these three elements provided an immediate reform, and it was not only just a change by design, but change by concept of operation.
Sure. You've mentioned several very interesting topics there. I'd like to return to the idea of personnel and the restructuring you mentioned that was central to police reform. How did you manage the dismissal process of these police officers? Because as you were saying, they are well trained, they had some specialized skills. This could have been a group of people that was disruptive. What were some of the policies you put in place to deal with this?
There were a number of this. First of all, those who've been involved in some kind of the misconduct were clearly dismissed and were warned that in case of they will continue illegal activities, they would face serious punishment. There were ones who expressed desire to get retraining and then to return back and work in different positions. So this opportunity was given to them. Most of them utilized this possibility. Some of them know because of their incapability to perform on a higher standards. But the biggest challenge in terms of the personnel management was, yes, and of course there was additionally created a huge incentives. Salary was increased many times. There was a special health insurance provided for every police or security officer, including their member of families. The equipment has been changed, it's radios, cars, other type of equipment, personal armament. They received the more confidence. They got special training how to interact with the people and get their support as well and the confidence from the society. And after this reform, it's interesting to mention that police enjoyed the highest popularity and public trust that showed the public opinion polls. But one of the biggest challenge was also integrating the security ministry within the Ministry of Interior, because security ministry has a very specific type of operation, and there was a heritage that we received also people who've been serving in the Soviet type of security services. And still they had, some of them had connections with the previously Soviet type of KGB system. So there was a suspicion that they might have again still maintaining these relations. So this was one of the biggest challenges. So we made a very thorough background check. Also, most of these people with the experience of the Soviet system were dismissed, but some of them who were at that time part of the system, so they were working as an honest officers, they received the special exit allowances that allowed him to try their possibilities in other private sphere rather than to stay in the law enforcement agency. So that was quite a complex program.
And who was the deciding body in terms of who would stay, who would be dismissed?
Yeah, there was a special personnel department who was updating all the material, collecting information through the different agencies. But in many cases, it was just a simple approach that those who had relations with the Soviet KGB system shouldn't be allowed in the new type of law enforcement agencies.
And on this issue of bringing a Soviet-style security service into the Ministry of Internal Affairs, one thing you've mentioned is depoliticization, the idea that previously security services had been used by various political groups within Georgia to their own gain. Was there a body or an oversight committee of any sort set up to ensure that this was not carried over into the new Internal Affairs Ministry?
Yes, that was more a broad political, let's say, framework of the all the reforms, not only in this sphere, but Ministry of Defense and other agencies, let's say the Foreign Intelligence Agency, etc. For this, we had a special parliamentary committee, which is called, and it still exists, it's a committee of trustees. This committee consists of members of parliament from the ruling party as well as from the opposition party. And this commission has a right to interrogate and investigate every case, even a top secret material. They have a special clearances for this. Of course, they are not allowed to speak about it publicly, but they can take any concern in society might exist and look in detail on each of these issues, starting from the financial issues and ending practical implementation or daily operation issues. And that was the most effective tool to provide a democratic oversight of the reform and functioning of security system, including Ministry of Defense and including foreign intelligence services.
Now, one thing that's come up in the past few years, indeed is going on right now in Georgia, is the issue of how police forces deal with peaceful democratic demonstrations. What kind of priority and what kind of program was set in to make that transition away from a more Soviet legacy approach?
First of all, key here is was the, and is the training. So in our police academy, all the personnel who might be in one way or another might be involved in this type of operation, managing the huge crowds, they received a special training. We, as I said, we had a good training program with the U.S. law enforcement agencies, but also we invited European police experts who were advising Ministry of Interior on a daily basis how to manage, and from those countries who have quite a good record of managing big crowds. We had a German expert, British expert, and some others as well. And also what is important that we set a clear rules of engagement for each of the policemen. And in this case, the detrimental for these rules of engagement was a decision made and minimal to be minimally involved on the scene of the protesting. So we had a minimal visibility of the police, not to cause some irritation. But on the other hand, the more stress was diverted towards preventing some possible provocations or some possible incidents and accidents. So less visibly but more effectively, police was working during these days, and as we can see, nothing major incident is happening, and police is very adequately, low profile but effectively reacting to this.
Now, depoliticizing police forces is a challenge a lot of countries have to face. What were, in your view, the major obstacles that Georgia overcome or is still dealing with? What were the hardest parts of this process?
First of all, politicization in many cases in the police sphere was linked to the corruption, because police, as every other law enforcement agency in the Soviet system, and in the post-Soviet systems as well, in parallel had a possibility to oversight any economic activity, any business activity. And this was a huge source of income, and therefore fitting in different political interests as well. So when the corruption schemes were destroyed, and we fight it seriously, when police was not in charge of any economic activities, and that was also a major decision, that we removed all the economic or financial type of duties from the agenda of police or security system, it significantly decreased the temptation to be involved in politics as well. And then next, also important thing was that to establish a very clearly set a career development program. So no high official will be and could be appointed because of some political consideration. He have to have a clear career planning in one or another place, and then can take a higher position. Of course, from the one position to another during the transition, he have to pass special training courses or seminars in order to fit in his new position. So this is a major element that decreases the possibility of politicization.
In terms of this career planning that you mentioned, how was that implemented, given that so much of the police force was dismissed? It would be, I imagine there were a lot of new recruits who didn't have much experience. So was there an educational requirement or a standardized test that people would...
My friends in Tbilisi can tell you more about it, okay, in the details, but there was a special board, of selection board, And it was really hard job performed by them, because at the time I was not there, but my friend. They were screening each single person recruited on each single position, this board, making his psychological portrait and his tests for IQ, etc., knowledge, special tests, and that was one of the key parameters while recruiting these people.
So each individual police officer would be reviewed by the board?
By the board, and the files collected, and then decisions made whether they appointed or not.
One thing we touched on was the question of brutality and internal monitoring in the police. Could you talk about some of those monitoring mechanisms? You mentioned the criminal investigation section in particular. What kind of bodies or officers were set up to ensure that?
There is a special body which is called the internal inspection, and what are the daily routine I cannot tell you because I was not involved in this, but you can get more information in Tbilisi. But what I see as a citizen, then there was a huge number of criminal cases when the police officers or other officials been arrested because they were doing some illegal activities. Unfortunately, most of these people who've been arrested were the former police who were again re-recruited. So that was also kind of a good indicator in terms of the personnel management.
I'd like to come back to this moment when the Ministry of State Security was folded into the Ministry of Internal Affairs. As when you approached it as in the state security, how did you balance between the two? Was there a sense that the internal affairs and state security would have to take staff cuts equally, or was it really the state security that lost there?
No, that was done in a more kind of pragmatic way. We designed the new organizational structure of the Ministry of Interior according to the requirements for Georgia, with particular structure and job descriptions. And then these people, based on their merit and knowledge and capabilities, were distributed. So it was not a mechanical merger or proportional decrease. It was just setting up a new system, but filling with the people who were serving in a different fields. And as I said, there was a lot of duplication. So there were quite many people with the skills or the same knowledge. So it was, then was kind of an empty structure created and then filled by the personnel.
And once the new structure had been staffed, was there an effort to address any continuing tension between former state security and former internal affairs?
That was, as I said, there was a rivalry between these two agencies, but basically this rivalry was because the heads of these agencies had a fight different spheres of influence. But once this was not policy from the top down, then these are normal professional people and they didn't have much problem to integrate with each other. Okay. In general terms, of course, there might be some minor incidents. Or...
And then once the new combined ministry was formed, in terms of promotion, were people, was it entirely from scratch again, you started beginning, or could someone transfer their rank, their level within the former one into this new one?
Yes, there was some rank structure established as a chart, and those people, maybe not the same chart, but some kind of equality because of their background, because of knowledge, or because of their file they've done before, of course they maintain the ranks, because it would be rather discouraging them, let's say, professional in the mid-age, mid-career, to... sent him in a low again in the beginning of his career step. So that's why there was a special mechanism how they transferred and maintained relatively the same ranking.
And tied into this idea of integrating the two service was the demilitarization and the restructuring. And you mentioned the internal troops, which is quite unique to the Soviet system, is really more of, as I understand it, a military unit.
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about that unit and how that presented a challenge to the police service that Georgia wanted post 2003?
This was a tool again for gaining influence. While there was a law enforcement, like a Ministry of Defense, Ministry of State Security had their own armored and militarized structure, and Ministry of Interior. Ministry of Interior was quite a big in its size countrywide, and they had quite a big military structure. And the main, their main function was, the idea was designed to use it in case, and it's a Soviet kind of a legacy, to use it in case that some disorders happen within the country. But in no democratic country can tolerate when the armed forces with the armored vehicles or tanks used against their own population. It was totally inadequate, and they were dismissed and then transferred to the Ministry of Defense, where is the place for the heavy armed military units.
In terms of demilitarization, the situation in Georgia with the conflict areas around Abkhazia and South Ossetia, just by virtue of their location, that police forces have in the past and may find themselves in a military type of situation, a military level of conflict. How is that reconciled in Georgia? How have you tried to keep policing to the police and military style operations to the military?
This is also quite well distributed between different agencies in the doctrines of each agency. And we have, of course, police. Within the police, there are border guards. They have a special portfolio and special area of operation. And there are maximum possible scenario where they can be involved. Let's say when border police can involve, if there is a minor border violation, if this violation becomes bigger that they cannot resist, then by law the Ministry of Defense has a possibility to provide an adequate support for this. So these are the special gradings in type of size and incidents. Let's say if police is countered by the armored vehicle, of course they cannot counter it, and then there are special units that can be and will be involved to counter them. And then if the size and the scope of this attack is larger, then it's more military confrontation, and then here comes the place for the military to be involved. So this is quite clearly distributed by the doctrines and by the law.
And of course some of these situations can unfold fairly quickly or unexpectedly. I was wondering, in last August 2008, the conflict, were there police units that were involved in that, whether consciously or just reactively?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a very interesting question, because let's take a conflict zones. Let's ask the question whether it's an internal issue or it's an external issue, whether it's a police task or the Ministry of Defense. Then we have to analyze what is the situation there. We have there heavily armed separatist regime. We have there additional foreign troops deployed with the heavy armament, artillery, air force. Of course, police can and will never be capable to cope potential threats coming from the heavily armed separatist unlawful regimes. So therefore, to counter this type of activities on our territory, when part of territory is occupied, is part of the Ministry of Defense. And on the ground, there were some arrangements. Well, before the August War, there were Georgian peacekeeping battalion involved, somehow to maintain, together with international observers, the peace and security there. But once the situation went beyond the local conflict and there was a large-scale invasion, as we'll see, then we were obliged by our law and by international law as well. This is Article 51 UN Charter, when every country has right of self-defense, and then armed forces were involved. But police has its own task as well during this type of operation, because when you are countering a military invasion, there are areas where people, society needs assistance. When there is looting, and the police have to maintain, and the militaries are not trained for this. So there is a good combination of both of them. And right now, we are writing a new security concept and a new military doctrine, which encompasses all different tasks all together, and interoperability of different agencies in one and the same theater of operation. And we see that it's necessary, and this is one of the lessons learned from the August War. Let's say our troops were trained, besides the military operations, to conduct some kind of a stabilization operations like they were doing in Iraq, in Kosovo, having interaction with the society and minimizing the possibility of other side effects of military activities, as I said, lootings or killing, helping people, search and rescue. So this is the combination of the multiple tasks.
And within the Ministry of Internal Affairs, as I understand it, there was some debate over whether there should be a change from military ranks, whether they should still have the same names and ranks as the old Soviet system, or they should move towards a more civilian nomenclature. Could you talk about that debate? What's important there, and how Georgia has dealt with that?
You mean in Ministry of Defense or Ministry
of the Police, Internal Affairs?
Yeah, that's also part of the element. In the Soviet system, in the police or security or military system, everybody has the military ranks. But the democratic concept of the civilian control of the armed forces and security system predisposes two elements, civilian and the military component. And this was also core of the reform that, let's say, Ministry of Interior or Ministry of Defense, there was a civilian ministry where there are particular jobs that were only civilian, including or starting from the minister, deputy ministers, head of the major departments. Most of the departments are the civilians. And this is the civilian position. And there are positions which requires the ranking, whether police ranking or military. In the Ministry of Defense, it's more easy to do because there is a ministry and the joint staff. So there is a clear separation, and this is the civilian oversight of military. In the police structure, it's not that kind of a clear division line, but having a civilian minister and deputy ministers, also heads of the department, helps to create this kind of a checks and balances system.
And on the level of individuals, you yourself have moved from the policing security sector to the closely related defense sector. What is the responsibility there for government servants when they move from one to the other? Because there will still, I assume, be these ties back to the old ministry. So how does one approach that? That new set of responsibilities?
In the first years of the reformation process, the daily routine and mechanism was almost the same, the changing the old system to the new one. We instantly started these reforms in every agency. So while moving from one agency to another, we had the understanding what the processes were going on there, what is the demands, and what are the particular items in the agenda. So we had a very close consultations with the predecessors, having in mind the challenges that each of these agencies had. So largely there was not a big difference in terms of the concept. Of course, the content was different, but for the content, there were professional people who were doing it. And in our case, ministers and deputy ministers are the not the career positions, but the political positions. So you are directing the policy, but the executives are the professional ones. So once I was coming to the new, or my colleagues were coming to the new agency, all the people were remaining in the same place and continuing their daily routine.
And when you look at the process of demilitarization in Georgia, What are the main obstacles that you foresaw and perhaps some that you didn't see? Because just by virtue of its geostrategic position, Georgia has some distinctly military concerns that it has to. So what were the real difficulties in balancing demilitarization?
It was not difficult at all, I think, because just in a sober-minded analysis clearly indicated to us that it's senseless to have two or three different armies with different doctrines and different chain of command. It's better to have one well-trained to the Western standard, well-fitted to the mission type of army, bigger but better equipped and positioned. It would improve the flexibility. It would be. It would improve the operational effectiveness. So it was easy to do. We just. It was a matter of the political decision. The previous government, quite corrupted government, they did not have this political will. Otherwise, it was not hard at all, and it was quite well perceived by society as well.
And on the. Again, on this militarization and the conflict areas in Georgia, a lot of countries, when they undertake some of the reforms that Georgia has done, they face this problem of working with non-state security groups. And I know throughout the decades of the 1990s, there were certain non-state groups in Georgia that could nevertheless exercise violence. What was the relationship? How did that relationship? Was there a relationship between the Georgian police post 2003 when you were involved and groups like that, and how was that managed?
Unfortunately, in 2003, this type of groups that you are speaking were non-existent. And some of these groups were absorbed to the law enforcement agencies because of their corrupted interest, but they were immediately dismissed. But we did not face these groups. And the decision was made, and it's clear that there is no necessity at all to have any type of other security arrangements or groups rather than defined by law.
One thing you've mentioned is the foreign assistance that Georgia received from states like the U.S. Could you talk about some of the drawbacks of a situation like that? Has the international assistance programs, they can, for example, they're often very expensive, a lot of the programs that the international community would like to see states implement. That's one concern we hear often. So what would be your evaluation of international assistance to Georgia?
Any type of assistance should be directed in some and aiming to some particular result. In our case, there was a willingness to support Georgia's democratic state to have a proper and adequate law enforcement system. But we designed and provided the vision we were heading for. So it was easy for our partner then to provide assistance because we knew what was the deliverable. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, it was not that expensive comparing to what results we achieved. It was very cost efficient.
And again, on this question of costs and outside support, there were two investment resource instruments, the Georgian Army Development Fund and the Law Enforcement Development Fund, which, as I understand it, were there to support reforms in both the defense and law enforcement sectors. Could you elaborate on what those were and why they were set up, how they were administered?
Yes. In 2003, when we came to power, the state budget was zero. There was no single penny in the state budget because of the previous corrupted government. So, but we and the society was requesting the immediate kind of deliverable results in terms of the security environment, the criminal environment. So there was a necessity to do something urgently. And anything you do, it requires some financial support. So we decided to set up temporarily fund that would be supported by Georgian compatriots abroad or somebody who would donate for the reform of armed forces or law enforcement agencies. But it was a temporary arrangement, and once the economy started functioning properly and there was money available in the budget, these funds are abolished. So there is no corruption and improvement of the revenue collecting agencies' daily work. Then we had enough resources to spend from the centralized budget, because this is the most transparent and the most acceptable way of financing any institution, especially law enforcement, rather than some type of funds.
On that note of transparency, I have come across the suggestion that the Georgian government, in running these funds, was not transparent as to how they were being expended and where the revenue was coming from. What were the dynamics behind the decision to be?
No, this was the temporary arrangement, as I said, and that was the donations of the individuals. And while, let's say, police was fighting the criminal gangs who were racketeering the businessmen. Of course, those businessmen were not willing that their names could be seen as the financier of the police. So, and it was a legitimate concern of theirs, and of course we could not, because of the justice transparency, sacrifice lives of people. And it was not institutionalized, but it was a temporary arrangement. So those who donated, they had their preconditions and quite a legitimate demand. So.
Sure. I'd like to step back for a second and talk about the broader reform environment that this was happening in. There was what we see is that when institutions try and undertake this level of reform and restructuring, you often inevitably have personnel who might not have the skills necessary to both carry out their job and to undertake the changes. So, in your experience, is there any advice you would give other political leaders in terms of sequencing reforms, stuff that should be a priority towards the beginning and other stuff that can wait until later?
Actually, it's a big luxury if you have a possibility to sequence events and to do it step by step in a calm environment, in a classical manner. But reality turns to be totally different, and you have parallelly a lot of pressing issues, and simultaneously you have to perform while also conduct the structural reform. So the only possibility sometimes is just to test these people on the on duty, whether they perform or not. But there were cases when people were charged on some responsibilities, but they could not perform, and then they moved to another position. Not because they are bad people, but they had not enough skills and they had not enough experience. So then we try to position them in a more proper place. That's the reality. But of course, in classical terms, it's better to do step-by-step sequence. One of my friends compared our situation is like building a ship in the middle of the sea while sailing, and while also learning how to sail, and while you have somebody attacking and trying to sink your ship. So this is happening. That's the reality.
And in terms of the reform process, what, in your experience, what were the crucial allies in institutions within Georgia and also abroad for what you were trying to do?
The most crucial ally is the people and the public support. This is the biggest capital that you can invest and then bear the fruits. When there is a public demand to put an end to the illegal criminal activities, and society, and you feel on a daily basis that society is happy that there is no racketeering of business, there is no stealing of car, it encourages you, and this is the biggest stimulus. From the outside support, this is the partners who know you, who are interested in supporting your system to be developed, democratic development, and also who share their experience, because once you are starting doing something, you should not invent bicycle. It's already invented. There are a lot of countries with the same or a bit different experience, but the best tool is to learn from them and then implement. So That was the knowledge and the experience shared by our friends and colleagues was the most invaluable thing.
And in terms of enacting these reforms, was there any point where you or your colleagues were unable to proceed with a particular initiative because you met lack of capacity in other parts of the government or political opposition that you had to overcome?
We were lucky enough to have our political team and the president himself, the more than 80% approval rating, which was more than enough to conduct smoothly the reforms. Of course, when you are conducting reforms, the degree of and the number of dissatisfied people are appearing, because when you are destroying some particular criminal gang, there are some families linked to them who were legally getting some income, so or any other reform. When you're firing, let's say, 30,000 traffic police in one day, this is the 30,000 opponents to you. But I think we used very effectively this political capital to do the first round of reforms. Of course, reforms are the never-ending process. You have to constantly reform. Once you stop doing it, then you are behind the schedule and you will lose the support, and even you might be dragged into the problem. So still we are doing reforms, and I hope and I'm sure that we will continue these reforms all the time.
Was there ever at any point a collapse or a breakdown in discipline or performance? I ask this because when we talk to a lot of people, they say that when internal management systems undergo change at the beginning, there is this breakdown in performance. Was there a dip that Georgia had to come out of it initially?
Yes, when you are changing structure, of course, in the first is that system is not functioning until it's reshuffled and starting new functions. So there were some decline in the security environment or the criminal. Also, there were some problems within the military units as well, unless new system was settled. But then it naturally happens, and it's impossible to avoid, especially when you have a very demanding environment and agenda and parallel doing reforms. But it was rather short, and we tried to make it as short as it was possible.
If you had to, say, write a guidebook for other political leaders attempting to overhaul their security and police forces, what would be the main topics in your experience that maybe the main ones you knew you would have to overcome and the ones that you just did not foresee there?
Well, each case is different, so any particular advice I cannot give you for sure, but generally any reform, especially in this field, requires first of all the political will and then resources. That's the two key elements, and result is imminent. And of course then the vision, what is the end state, where you want to take this system, not to start reform because of the reform's sake, but having in mind the end goal, lighthouse where you're heading.
What is that? What is that lighthouse? What is the future of this reform in Georgia?
This is the maximum confidence from the society, and society feeling confident with their law enforcement, not disturbed, but just making comfort to them on a daily life. And this is quite easy measurable. There are tools in sociology. These are the polls, public opinion polls, and this is the only measure. Before you start, of course, and that's what we did, before we started, we made a questioning of our society, what were their concerns, most, least, etc. And then we started reforms to tackle these issues.
Okay. And do you think is there anything particular to the reform of the police services that we haven't covered, a major topic that you think is worth recording?
One element in Georgian case was also very important, the decentralization of the system. The previous system was very much centralized pyramid, because when there is a corrupted system, the centralized pyramid is the best way to control, because the lowest level corruption feeds the higher, and all the money goes to the top of the pyramid. When you decentralize, you are decentralizing decision-making process, but also decentralizing responsibility. And you are avoiding any attempt of creation of the corrupted schemes. There might be some corruption on the local level, but then it's easy to neutralize because and to save rest of the system. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the key elements of the reform, and I think quite successful, decentralization of the system, including decision-making.
Now, I imagine the higher levels of the centralized Ministry of Internal Affairs would have been a bit unwilling or a bit resistant to that process of decentralization because that is a loss of power at the center.
Yes.
How is that something that came about through political leadership, or what allowed you to overcome that initial inertia of a pyramid?
Again, it's a matter of political will. When a ruling power is willing to use the police or law enforcement as a political tool, they need it centralized. But when you need this tool as a tool of democratic society, just maintaining law and order, you don't need it centralized. You need an oversight policy to control them, but let them perform their duty. So it's a matter of political will and what type of political system or political team is in power.
Sure. And one problem sometimes with decentralization is that you decentralize power, but you also decentralize responsibility. So we're talking about the general inspections that were set up for internal monitoring. How was that internal monitoring extended into the localities after this decentralization?
I am not an expert on a daily basis how it happened, but there is a separate system who has a special tools to measure, and these tools are public opinions as well, because when in some remote region the police is not doing something properly, you can immediately get sense from the people. So that required, of course, change and transformation of the working methods of the Inspector General as well, to have a more close relations with individual low-level policemen, also with the society, and getting these senses and the comparing, making analysis. And that's why there was created also a separate unit within, and it's functioning very successfully, and you will meet the head of this unit, analytical unit department, Shota Otiashvili. So this analytical unit largely helped to maintain a good monitoring system. So you have all the country on the screen, and you immediately see if there is some problem of misconduct or improper behavior, and then you are pinpointedly targeting this. So it's much easier to control.
Now, it would seem in the wake of the events of late 2003, early 2004, what have since been known as the Rose Revolution, the police was identified specifically as a priority of President Saakashvili. What was the reasoning behind that choice? Why was police singled out?
Many reasons. First of all, the police is where government directly interacts with the rest of the population and society. And this is the tool which can immediately affect the normal way of life by tackling the criminal, by providing basic human rights, also improving the general atmosphere in the country, and law and order is the key once it's established, especially for the society who was passing through this chaotic period when there were paramilitary groups and some corrupted policemen, corrupted security officers. So that was the key, and it gave an immediate effect.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. Appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome.